It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Do you ever go to a museum or gallery and wonder how on earth an artist came up with that?
So I started playing with shea butter probably about 12 or 13 years ago.
This is Rashid Johnson. He's a rising star in contemporary art.
I was sitting in my bathroom listening to a show on National Public Radio. It was the Tavis Smiley Show.
Oh, yeah.
Used to come on at 2 p.m. So I was sitting in my bathroom listening to the Tavis Smiley Show and putting on shea butter. And I got a call from a friend. He asked me what I was doing.
Sitting in the bathtub listening to public radio. Yeah.
Putting on shea butter.
Shea butter.
And he said, oh, that sounds like a really interesting work.
Okay, that wouldn't be my reaction, but we're talking about how artists work.
It kind of led to me thinking about how complicated the material was. Its relationship to Africa and an Africanness.
Because it's from West Africa, right? Shea butter?
It is. It's a West African material that comes from a nut. It's often put in a lot of different products that we use today, even jergens and different lotions.
Pretty much everybody has put shea butter on their skin. They just may not realize it.
Everybody is using shea butter and they may not realize it. So they are all engaging in some sort of relationship with Africa that they may not necessarily be aware that they are.
We're standing in front of one of Rashid Johnson's newest works in a one-man show at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's a long, heavy wooden table piled with big sculptural blocks of shea butter. And when you get close, you can see that the table itself has been burned in places. It looks almost like a ritual.
It is kind of a ritual experience. I built a large forge, and then I have these steel brands. Some of them are kind of like gun sights. Others are just circles, triangles. But the steel brands go into the forge and are heated almost like a cattle brand. And then it burns into the table. So there's this scarring or this scarification of the material. And by placing the shea butter on top of it, you kind of imagine beginning the healing process for those scars.
Yeah. So what began as a private moment in a bathtub turned into a piece full of historical allusions to slavery and colonial trade. This is what fascinates me about Rashid Johnson. He's always thinking about the complicated relationship, the push and pull between individual and collective identity. The biggest piece here is actually a box or a room, four sides of open black scaffolding spilling over with tropical plants, an organ, and books. Lots of books. This is just spectacular. It's like we're looking at a gigantic bookcase, but then with all this lush greenery.
And the plants are all from different places. So you have kind of cactus, you have palms, you have all of these disparate plants from different places kind of living together in a way. I think it's almost a metaphor for the collective us in some ways.
How does the organist even get in there?
They have to kind of climb in, and then they have to kind of force their body up into the middle of the space. So it's kind of a trying experience, but I think it's more rewarding when you get inside.
Have you gone in there yourself and sat in there?
I spent quite a bit of time inside of the sculpture. It's a really interesting place to be. It feels kind of like a womb in some way, but it feels warm, and you feel kind of alone, even though there are people standing around, but they can't necessarily see you so well.
Can we look at some of the books?
Sure.
Which ones are most important to you?
I guess one that I think is really interesting is a book by W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk. And Du Bois is a scholar and writer, all-around kind of brilliant race man is what he at different times called himself. There's a book by Deborah Dickerson called The End of Blackness, which explores the idea of blackness being kind of an antiquated way of exploring what identity and what culture is.
Mm-hmm. Your mother's a professor of African history?
Yeah, my mother is a professor of African history with an emphasis on post-colonial feminist theory.
So you grew up in a house filled with books?
I grew up in a house filled with books. A lot of incredibly intimidating titles like Harold Cruz, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, as well as a lot of important canonized literary figures.
So you grew up, your mom's a professor of African colonial history. There was that period when she was wearing dashikis.
You're a child of the Afrocentric generation, child of the Black Power generation. What did that mean, like, in your family growing up?
It was an incredibly prideful thing in my family growing up. We celebrated Kwanzaa. We were very involved in, you know, learning some Swahili and lighting of the candles. In a lot of ways, I felt like we grew up without the idea of imagining ourselves as victims. I was raised truly believing the idea of Black being beautiful. You know, that can be complicated because just because you don't see yourself as a victim doesn't mean that you're not subject to victimhood.
As you can imagine, one of the first things a young man with that kind of upbringing would want to do is visit Africa, the place he'd been hearing stories about all his life.
I didn't get to travel to Africa until I was 19 years old. A friend and I worked in public works, like kind of garbage special pickup to save money to send ourselves. And I made it there by age 19, and I was able to visit Du Bois' house in Ghana.
That must have been incredible. What's his house like?
You know, it was pretty amazing. One of the materials that kind of came out of it for me was that he had all these beautiful Persian rugs, and I thought to myself, wow, what was his obsession with these rugs? And it kind of led to me exploring that material as well.
So you had this childhood in which, you know, your family and so many people at the time were really focused on in what ways are we African?
Right.
And so what was that like?
I wasn't African in a lot of ways that Africans identified as African. And my experience was different. My narrative was different and my history was different. And I realized just how Western I was when I got there.
Thus began the reinvention of Rashid Johnson.
It really made me dig into kind of how my own personal exploration didn't necessarily need to be married to a collective idea of place in order to kind of fulfill for me what the journey would look like going forward.
This is a theme Rashid Johnson comes back to over and over again in his work, place. You're part of a group of four artists, right, who just collectively pooled some money to buy Nina Simone's home?
We did. And I think it kind of comes back to the experience of getting an opportunity to visit Du Bois' house and just how important it was for me that it was his home and that these kinds of spaces, when we save them and when we're given the opportunity to visit them and cherish them, that we learn so much about the people who actually occupied those spaces and those homes.
What is that, do you think? Because I've had the same experience. There's nothing like visiting a writer or artist's house, the place where they did their work. I don't know, you see their bedroom, you see their bathroom, the dishes that they ate off of. I don't know why it should matter so much, but it does.
It really does. There's a poetry of place. You know, it's hard to explain, but it's something that I know personally from experience, and I think it's important to make sure that in times like these, especially with what's happening in places like North Carolina, where you have the Voting Rights Act being challenged so aggressively, that we make sure that we are able to save certain kinds of spaces and make sure that people in those places know that we care.
Why you wanna fly, blackbird? You ain't ever gonna fly.
Rashid Johnson. He's the subject of a new exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and you can take a look at it on our website at ttbook.org.
No place big enough for holding all the tears you're gonna cry.
So you probably know what it's like to reinvent yourself. Something about the familiar box you've been living and working in just doesn't fit anymore. You feel like people aren't seeing who you really are. Well, that's a theme that runs through writer Teju Cole's work. This is a guy who's reinvented himself 5 or 6 times. He started in art history, became a novelist, then a photographer. He was one of the first writers to turn Twitter into an art form. Then he abandoned that. Now he's come out with a book of essays and photographs called Blind Spot. He told Steve Paulson that word has several meanings for him.
If you're looking a lot, at some point, you become aware of the limitations of looking. The more you look, the more you realize that in everything you're looking at, you're missing something. And it becomes a kind of a haunting question. But then the other thing that happened was that sometime around 2011, I had an episode with my eyes. I woke up one morning and I was blind in my left eye. Of course, very startling. I wasn't in pain. I just couldn't see. And the right eye wasn't doing so great either. So, of course, this is a nightmare for anyone. And it's a
especially for you,
especially
who's a photography critic.
Art historian, photography guy. And it went away, this veil, this occlusion, over the course of a couple of days. But sorting it out with doctors, they could not quite figure out what was going on. And eventually, I got a diagnosis. And the diagnosis I got from this top specialist on retinal problems, he said, well, you've got something called big blind spot syndrome. But it's something I kept thinking of about afterwards. And it changed my photography.
Really? How so?
I was already looking intently and I started to look more intently, more patiently. My photography got a bit more meditative, a bit more mysterious. I began to pay attention to the ordinary in a more focused way.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that is striking when I look at your photographs. I mean, the ones that you have taken is, I mean, they're often, they're the back alleys, the,
yes,
you know, the side streets,
yeah,
the a tarp that's hanging over a shack. It's,
yes,
it's not,
yeah,
you know, the usual tourist kinds of photos that we would see.
That's right. Having eye trouble made the ordinary glorious. It's just the way the sun falls across concrete. The discovery for me was finding out the highly personal way I wanted to do this. And that was simply to make images out of the ordinary and then to draw from that the extraordinary narrative that might be lying behind that image, that city, or that country, if it was a place I was visiting.
So this is a book where basically each page has one image and a short bit of text that you've written, often,
yeah,
just one paragraph. And sometimes it's directly referencing the picture that you've taken. Sometimes not at all.
Yes.
It's just sort of some oblique reference. And,
yes,
sometimes you're like referring to old books, you,
yeah,
know, the Iliad,
yes,
or, you know, your favorite writers,
yes,
biblical references.
Yes.
What's the connection between text and image here?
I wanted to make a book that was a little bit novelistic, but with none of the things you expect from a novel. Novels usually don't have 150 color photographs. And yet I wanted to give it this energy of a novel or a documentary film, just a very peculiar one. So in one sense, it was about the excitement of working in a new genre, a genre I was developing myself.
Hmm. Now, it's worth pointing out that these are photos that you've taken all over the world. And I started jotting down some of these places.
Yes.
Lagos, where you grew up, Nuremberg, Tivoli, Nairobi, Auckland, Tripoli, Milan, Berlin, Zurich, Copenhagen, Seoul, Bombay, Sao Paulo, Brooklyn, Beirut, Bali. The list goes on and on. I take it you like to travel.
I get to travel a lot and I take a lot of pleasure from it and I get a lot of productive discomfort from it. There's a way that outsiderness can help you understand what you're an insider to. Being a Nigerian American in America helps me to understand Nigeria in a more intense way.
So it's easier for you to write about Nigeria when you're here in the U.S.?
No writing is easy, but it affords me a certain insight into it. Knowing it while looking at it from a distance, being in Nigeria, having grown up in Nigeria, illuminates my understanding of American, even though I'm an American.
I want to pick up a little bit on your own personal history, your background, because it's obviously informed your writing. You were born in the U.S., right, in Michigan.
Yes.
But then quickly, your family moved
within a few months
to Lagos.
Yes.
And you grew up there for how long? How many
17
years? 17 years.
Yeah.
And then came back to America?
And then I came back to the U.S., back to the Midwest, back to Kalamazoo for university. We had no money, very little, but I came to the U.S., I got some scholarships, I got some loans, and then I had to start learning what it meant to be here as an American who was Nigerian. It was almost as if for the first time I was also learning that I was black, did not need to be stated in Nigeria because everybody else around me was black. And in the U.S., now I had to learn the racial politics of the U.S.
So when you first came here, it sounds like you did not have the experience of most African Americans.
I did not.
And so, but then over time, you started having those experiences.
Well, I've been in the U.S. for 25 years. I'm a black guy in America, of course. You know, it's inevitable. But, you know, within those first couple of years, there are many things I did not have a narrative for. What does it mean if I'm strolling around in a small town in Michigan and a car slows down, the window is wound down, and someone shouts the N-word at me? I had to figure out what to think about that. But also, what does it mean if I'm in a social space, in a university setting, and somebody says to me, oh, you're not like those other blacks? What does that mean? You know, and all of this stuff had to be understood. And, you know, it took time, but my experience of life is as a black person in America.
But you live in Brooklyn now?
I live in Brooklyn. I live in the U.S., yeah. So.
And do you consider Brooklyn home?
I consider Brooklyn home because that's where my wife is. My brother lives there. My friends are there. My books are there. So that's home. I consider Lagos home. My parents live there. It's where I grew up. If I go to Nigeria, my room is there. It's a place where the two most spoken languages in Lagos, Yoruba and English, are languages I'm fluent in. So there's an at-homeness. But home is also wherever there's good Wi-Fi. That's home. That connects me to the world in a way that is irreducible and as essential to my experience of the world.
Do you consider yourself more Nigerian or more American?
Neither. Split right down the middle, or rather 100% of both. I feel very invested in Nigeria's future. There's a book I've been working on for a long time about Lagos. So I think about Nigeria a lot. I'm American, and America is in crisis at the moment. I feel invested in being an American who, with other Americans, thinks about what this country ought to be. I'm a citizen who is not a patriot, but I'm a citizen in the sense of being invested in what do we owe each other? What do we do to protect each other's rights? Those philosophical questions are very interesting to me. If my money is being used to kill foreigners in a theater of war, that's my business. So I'm very American in that way, and I'm also very Nigerian in that way.
So the two cities that you've spent the most time in are Lagos and New York City.
Yeah.
Are they just two totally different experiences for you, or do they have certain similarities? I mean, obviously two huge cities.
Well, the commonalities are very similar. It is the experience of cosmopolitanism, which is maybe the fourth definition of home for me.
You're comfortable in cities.
I'm comfortable among cosmopolitan people who share some of my assumptions about these conversations I've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody says, you know, gays should be hanged or Muslims should be shot, I say, well, no, that's not the conversation. The conversation is, how is somebody whose sexuality is different, somebody whose religion is different, how is that person able to inhabit the same space and have the same rights and respect as anybody else?
That's sort of the core value of cosmopolitanism, right?
Absolutely.
So what would you say are some of the biggest differences between Lagos and New York?
New York is much richer. Lagos might have 25 buildings of monumental scale, and New York has 300. It never ceases to surprise me, the sheer physical scale of New York. And then there's that thing in New York of being a world capital. Lagos is the capital of Africa. Don't let people in Cairo or Johannesburg tell you different. You know, it's all lies. Lagos is the place.
The home guy talking.
Yeah,
here.
But Lagos is the place where the pop culture of Africa is being made. And so Lagos is the capital of Africa, but New York is the capital of the world. So that New York is almost not an American city. It's a city that's a vision of what does the world look like if these borders are not as they are right now.
I'd love to end, actually, with a passage from your book, Open City, which is set in New York, kind of a novel of New York and where you are wandering, and which sort of, I think, gets at some of the things that we've been talking about. Could you read that?
Yes, thank you. Open City is a book of wandering. And what I really wanted to evoke over the course of this book was psychological intensity, but also a sense of plenty. At first, I encountered the streets as an incessant loudness, a shock after the day's focus and relative tranquility, as though someone had shattered the calm of a silent private chapel with a blare of a TV set. I wove my way through crowds of shoppers and workers, through road constructions and the horns of taxicabs. Walking through busy parts of town meant I laid eyes on more people, hundreds more, thousands even, than I was accustomed to seeing in the course of a day. Each neighborhood of the city appeared to be made of a different substance. Each seemed to have a different air pressure, a different psychic weight. The bright lights and shuttered shops, the housing projects and luxury hotels, the fire escapes and city parks. My futile task of sorting went on until the forms began to morph into each other and assume abstract shapes unrelated to the real city. And only then did my hectic mind finally show some pity and still itself. Only then did dreamless sleep arrive.
Teju Cole, talking with Steve Paulson. Teju's new book is called Blind Spot, and you can see some of the photographs in it on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to a much longer interview Steve did with him in the Millions. So we're talking this hour about reinventing yourself, getting outside boxes. Well, writers have a word for those boxes, genres. Here's Lauren Bucus with A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Lauren Bucus, the author of Broken Monsters, and my dangerous idea is that we should get rid of genre altogether. I am so tired of the very artificial argument that there is literature and there is science fiction and that there is westerns and crime novels, and that these are all somehow different and have different value systems. As far as I'm concerned, we should be promiscuous in our reading habits. We should take any damn book we like to bed, as long as that book is good in bed, or in the bath, or on the sofa, or wherever you like to read. You probably shouldn't read with your e-reader in the bath, but, you know. So the idea is that we have stories, and we have good stories and bad stories, and we have stories that use different elements, but to reduce them into these kind of little boring pigeonholes where they have to fit certain criteria is so frustrating and tedious. I think we miss out on a lot of really good books. And of course, there's bad sci-fi, but it also depends on what your idea of science fiction is. It's a very broad church. It's the same with crime. You might have a really tedious little murder mystery which breaks out all the cliches about pretty dead girls and the serial killer creeping up on people, and we've seen it all before. And then you might read a crime novel like Gone Girl, which just blows you out of the water. These distinctions, they're fake. They don't exist. We need more hybrid novels. We need novels which can take their inspiration from the world. Read what you want to read. Make yourself happy. Read challenging, adventurous, dangerous books across different genres. Surprise yourself.
Lauren Bucus, author of Broken Monsters.
Okay.
Next, Charles Monroe Kane meets a former pop singer turned jazz crooner and sees the light.
I'm inspired. I'm ready to go. Change the world now.
Awesome. Go do it.
I'll go do it. I got soul in my soul now. It's all ready to go.
Wow.
I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and...
I know, right? Now we're good.
PRX. That was Nika Costa then. And this is her now. Quite a change. You're listening to singer Nika Costa and her band doing a sound check at NPR's LA studio. Nika got an early start in music. When she was 5 years old, she sang with Don Ho. By 9, she had a number one song in South America. By 10, she was a pop sensation in Europe. She went on to become Britney Spears' opening act. But that pop music is behind her now, and she's doing something pretty different, or in some ways very familiar. Nika's father was Frank Sinatra's arranger. Sinatra was her godfather, and she's gone back to her musical roots in her new album. It's called Nika and Strings, Underneath and In Between. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her.
Nika, how would you describe this thing? What is this thing, this album, this Nika and Strings, Underneath and In Between thing? Like, how would you describe it?
Well, it's a string quartet with a rhythm section. For me, it's kind of a full circle to where I started and just historically, you know, kind of growing up with my dad and kind of doing homework in the orchestra pit and just being around those kind of performers, you know, like Sammy Davis and Frank Sinatra, and kind of as a kid taking it for granted, but it kind of sank in to my psyche. So it's a very kind of comfortable place for me to be. And I've always known I would kind of do this music at some point, but it's not your grandma's classy record. It's kind of, it's got like a hump on it. Everything has groove on it, which is very me. It's like standards, but through my filter. So,
well, let's hear one. Let's hear Come Rain or Come Shine, which to me is you kick it for your version.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine, high as a mountain, deep as a river. Come rain or come shine.
So why that song? What inspired you to do that particular song?
Well, it's always been a favorite of mine that Dad did with Frank from back in the day. And I was cleaning out my office and I stumbled across literally underneath, like shoved underneath these shelves, this huge arrangement. And it said Rain or Shine, FS Reprise, Don Costa, and like the address where, you know, I grew up as a kid. And I called Jeff and I said, Jeff, you got to come over here. Like, what is this? You know, so he comes over and reads through it. You know, kind of we both realize that it's the actual arrangement that was on Frank's record.
Wow.
I don't know how I ended up with it. It's just this one of these weird things. But I said to Jeff, can you possibly squash this 60-piece arrangement, you know, down to our humble, you know, quartet and rhythm section? And he, you know, took it home, and I think he did an amazing job. And it's so special to me because it's like being with my dad for that kind of little 3 or 4 minutes each time we play it. So it's very cool.
You know, I was thinking about tell us about your dad. What was he like, and what was it like growing up, that wild life you had as a little kid? It sounds so interesting. What was he like?
Well, my dad was super funny, and he was always making faces and jokes, and he's this kind of Italian, you know, big Italian family, and, you know, just music everywhere all the time. But, you know, as a kid, kids are really just more like they don't really care who their parents' friends are, you know.
Right.
So my parents' friends happen to be kind of singers and musicians and stuff. But
I think we should interrupt just to make sure it's very clear. Your parents' friends were Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra. Your parents' friends were some of the greatest musicians ever. That's who you hung out with, yeah.
Totally. So I'd be like, Frank, throw me in the pool. You know, like, that was pretty much it. I have this photo of me when I'm about 3 and Sammy Davis Jr., and he's cracking up. So it was just, those were my folks. And,
right.
And it was crazy. Like, Sly Stone was in my living room. I always tell the story because I remember it so well. I was trying to sleep, and, you know, my parents were, you know, jamming. And I heard this guy, you know, outside playing piano. I was just like, ah, so aggravated. I was trying to sleep. I was probably about 6, and I just wanted to go to school the next day and just And I run out there, and there's this guy, and he's in red spandex and a white Mickey Mouse sweatshirt and a huge afro, and he's just banging on the piano. And I'm like, hey, shut up. I'm trying to sleep. I got school tomorrow. And it was Sly Stone. So, doof. You know, had I known years later, I'd be idolizing his funk mastery.
You know, it's interesting when I hear you talk about, and I've read so much about your past growing up. I was thinking about your biography, and you're talking about people you're around. People that I think are special is the late Prince, who I know you were friends, and he was your mentor. Tell me about that, about your relationship with him and the music that you were able to do with him.
Yeah, well, that was just an awesome surprise of life. I'd, you know, grown up a huge, huge Prince fan, and he reached out to me online, like, Nico, will you come to the park and play with us?
So then you got to say yes to that one, right?
It's pretty much.
Yeah, yep.
But, you know, so we went to Paisley, you know, that's where the gig was. And, you know, I didn't know if I'd meet him. I didn't know if he'd be like the Wizard of Oz, right, like behind the curtain, you know, whatever. We were sound checking, and, you know, we were in the Paisley Park, and all of his outfits that you ever remember from Ever Video were hanging there. And I can I say the S word on
sure,
here?
Sure, go ahead.
So we were told not to swear, but anyhow, that's obviously really hard for me. So I looked up, and I'm like, oh, shit, look, you know, da-da-da. And I my eyes go down from looking at the ceiling, and don't, there he is. I'm like, oh, shit, because I just said shit in front of friends, which I wasn't supposed to. So I just kept saying shit, and it was so bad. And then he was like, have you ever been to Paisley before? And I said, no. He's like, you want to come check it out? I'm like, yeah. So I was asking him all kinds of questions, and he was just super cool and very generous. And then over the years, you know, we just became friends, and he would bring me out on the road, and we wrote together and jammed together and watched movies. And right. He was just very generous with advice and support. And yeah.
Can you please, for me, I'm sure the song is going to become a hit. I would assume it will. Everyone I played it for loves it. Will you do your cover of Prince's Nothing Compares to You for us, because it's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing, say nothing can take away these blues.
That's Nika Costa performing Nothing Compares to You by the late Prince. It's on her album Nika and Strings, Underneath and In Between. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. A few weeks ago, we were having a staff meeting, and Doug Gordon said he'd just done an interview with Michael Nesmith. And the guys around the table were like, who? And I said, Michael Nesmith from the Monkees?
Are you kidding?
Hey, hey, we are the Monkees. You know we love to please. A manufactured image with no philosophies.
Okay, for those of you not old enough to remember, the Monkees were this smart, funny, adorable pop group in the early 60s. They had this zany TV show. I was a six-year-old super fan. I watched their show every week, and I still remember all their names. There was Davy, the really cute one with the British accent, the one everybody had a crush on. Mickey, the second cutest. Peter, the quiet one with the blonde page boy. And Michael Nesmith, the one in the green stocking cap. Okay, so the Monkees faded out sometime when I was in third grade. But Michael Nesmith turns out to have had a really interesting second and third and, I don't know, now fourth career. He sort of invented country rock and the music video. He wrote two novels. He worked in film, TV, and virtual reality. And after all that, he's come out with a memoir called Infinite Tuesday, an autobiographical riff. And lucky for you and me, Doug Gordon sat down to talk with him.
So, Michael, one of several things that I think you invented, or at least helped to invent, is country rock. And one of the great examples of the pioneering country rock that you created is a song called Listen to the Band. Can you tell me about this song?
Well, I can try. I mean, Listen to the Band came out of a studio.
I wanted to go into the studio before the Monkees was over, right at the end of it. I called Felton Jarvis, who was a producer. He was Elvis's producer, but I called him up. I'd known him. I said, I'd like to bring a band into the studio. Can you put something together? What he put together was the Muscle Shoals bass that had just started to play and was completely rearranging the way people thought about R&B and that deep South gospel-driven music that Aretha sang and so forth. So I was late one day going into the studio, and when I walked in the door, these guys had been just jamming and riffing and doing stuff on their own. They said, okay, well, here you are. You're late. We're really good. But I just heard them play. These were session cats that were playing at the top of the form. So I played them, listened to the band. And they started playing to it in a way that was very far outside country music. It was very far inside rock and roll. Mm-hmm. It had opened up some of the same windows and doors that the big power players were opening up. The drummers and the bass player and Briggs on the piano and everything locked it down into this R&B slow tramping march of the Spartans.
Listen to the band.
It laid into a groove that I'd never heard before. Never heard anything before like it.
Oh, mercy, woman, plays a song and no one listens. I need help, I'm falling again. Play the drum a little bit louder. Tell them they can live without her if they only listen to the band.
One of the things you invented, quote-unquote, invented in, I think it's fair to say, well, I'll let you respond, was MTV, music television. Can you tell me how you did that?
Well, no, I don't, because I really didn't invent it. I was there at the birth of it.
Okay.
And it started with the music video. I'd been asked by Chris Blackwell, who was the owner, and I think he may still be, of Island Records, when I delivered Rio to them to distribute, if I would be willing to make a clip for Rio that he could use to promote the record around the European continent. It would get played on television that way. Well, I didn't know what he was talking about, so I had to go and do some research. Well, there weren't hardly any out there, but the ones that were out there were people standing up in front of a microphone and singing. That would drive record sales. But I didn't have anything like that in my idea about how I would do one. I thought, well, I want it to look like an old-time movie. We went into the edit bay. We said, okay, let's just start putting pictures on this thing. So we put one picture, and we added another picture to it. And after about the sixth or seventh picture, a very curious thing started to happen. The music took over the narrative. The music was the continuity.
I'm hearing the light from the window. I'm seeing the sound of the sea. My feet have gone loose from their moorings. I'm feeling quite wonderfully free. And I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night.
And the images fit that continuity in a way I had never seen. Once it was finished, Bill and I looked at each other and said, this is extraordinary. I don't know what this is. And Bill says, I don't either, but I'm moving out from Detroit. And when I got back, I started showing it around, and everyone would say, this is unbelievable. What is this? I said, well, it's a way to present music in the age of video. It's a music video.
Yeah.
And nobody had heard that word. Nobody knew, had any idea what it was. And I was driving home, and this is what I mean by I did not invent MTV, because I'm not sure anybody invents anything anyway. But be that as it may, I'm driving home. I'm going down the road, and I think, if I've got a music video, what is the player for that? And just as clear as a bell, I said, with television. You know, a television is to the music video what radio is to the record. And I thought, yes, that's it.
Reno, why Reno?
Not Reno.
Rio, Rio de Janeiro.
I always figured it was a billion-dollar idea, but I was really grateful to have been part of the early days of it. It was a great ride, but I didn't invent it.
I think it's fair to say you're one of the founding fathers.
Yeah, that I'll take that.
Yeah, okay,
good. Do I get a three-pointed hat?
Yeah, you do. I'll work on that. A three-pointed hat and a tote bag. We'll get you that.
Okay.
Your mother, Betty Nesmith Graham, invented liquid paper, and you, of course, have led a very creative and innovative life. So how much of your creativity and imagination do you think comes from your mother?
Well, none of it. I don't know that we get that from other individuals or other people. I think we get it from divine life and divine intelligence. I think it's given to us in equal measure, and that we have also given to us in equal measure the power to do something with it.
Your mother practiced the religion Christian Science, and at one point she encouraged you to listen to a leading Christian Science teacher, a guy named Paul Seely, go to hear him speak, and you did that. What did you think of Seely?
When she was going through some very difficult troubles with her company, Liquid Paper Company, she went to talk to this man, Paul Seely, and she said, I've really found somebody that's exceptional, and I think you would enjoy talking to him. And I said, you know, Ma, I'm just not really down with this. I don't think this is something I want to do. She said, well, this I think you'll find extraordinary and exceptional, and will you do it just for me? And so I said, yeah, I'll do it just for you. When I met him, I started to get a glimpse into the higher mind, into higher consciousness, into what it meant to think with a truly extraordinary and divine intelligence, to have a sense of infinity that I didn't have, and the ability to practice and explain it and to live it in one's life and to teach it. So it was mind-altering. Now, you'll hear the same story from anybody who's searching for a teacher, anybody who's looking for their guru. Just as a indication of the way he was thinking, he said to me, the one thing you want to watch out for is a sense of personality. And personality is not a real thing. It does not provide anything. So let it go. And I thought, well, I think I can do this. I'm not sure what he means by personality, but I am now. I understand what he was talking about with that.
What was he talking about?
He was talking about a personal sense. He was talking about a sense of an ego inside a body that has all of these entitlements and that has all of these ideas that steer it around, and that's not true thinking and it's not true intelligence. That divine intelligence comes from divine life and divine truth, and that's a truth that if we know – sets us free. And of course, that's what I was looking for. How do I get out of this mess? If that rings true, if you see what I mean.
I do know what you mean, yeah. Last year, the Monkees released this album called Good Times. It was produced by Adam Schlesinger from the band Fountains of Wayne and featured songs written by Rivers Cuomo of Weezer and Andy Partridge of XTC. I think it was one of the best albums of the year. And one of the highlights is a song called I Know What I Know, which you co-wrote with Adam Schlesinger, right?
No, I wrote it by myself.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And then I heard that darn internet, it lies. And then you got to do something about that, Michael.
Or are you just figuring that out?
No, but I mean, this is yet another example. I got busted. So yeah. That's what I thought. You just wrote it. But anyway, I think it's one of your most beautiful vocal performances ever.
Oh, thanks.
Can you tell me a bit about this song?
Well, it was just a song I wrote. I wrote, you know, like I write songs. I sit around and write. I had a divorce about 7 years ago that was just extremely painful for me. And, you know, it was a way to get a lamentation into a song that wasn't morose, that it had more of an uptick to it. So I found myself thinking not just about the fact that I'd lost a marriage, but thinking that it pointed me to realizing my need for a divine presence and my need for God. And that's what the song is basically about.
I know what I know, and what I know is I know nothing without you. I know what I see, and what I see is I see nothing without you. Alone I am with waiting heart. Alone I am, a world apart. I know what I know. I see what I see. I love what I love. It's you that I love.
That's Michael Nesmith with I Know What I Know from the Monkees album Good Times. Nesmith's new memoir is called Infinite Tuesday, and that was Doug Gordon talking with him. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher, or visit our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Mark Rickers, and Karen McKechnie. Joe Hartke is our technical director. I'm Ann Strangeamps, and thanks to you for listening.